Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, on the internet at hallel.info. In this study, we explored how God calls us by name, transforming our identity from who we were to who He wants us to be. Through passages in Genesis, Isaiah, and Matthew, we see God's covenant invitation to find rest in the leadership of Messiah Yeshua, Christ Jesus. Just as God renamed Jacob as Israel, we're called to shed our old nature and embrace a new identity, taking on Yeshua's light yoke of divine purpose and instruction, and experiencing true spiritual rest.
And Genesis 35, verse 9 through 36, verse 43, and Isaiah 43, verses 1 through 7, and Matthew chapter 11, verses 25 through 30. And all of those are connected really with three particular major themes, one of which is identity. And you could say these are questions that were being asked of Yaakov, then to be renamed Israel. Well, who are you? And it's a question really all of us should ask ourselves. And in a sense, that's a question that heaven keeps asking all of us. Who are you? And another one of covenant and divine calling. What does heaven want? Because a covenant is a deal. It's a contract, right? Well, a contract always has terms. Deals always have terms to the contracts. So what does heaven want? And how will heaven and you respond? So those are things that we see continually happening through the lives of all of the patriarchs. And it's something we see with us today when we talk about we are called into the covenant that heaven has made with earth through Father Abraham. And we've read about that going all the way back to Genesis 12. That's when it was revealed that through you would be a blessing for all nations on the earth. So, big question of that covenant and that divine calling to come into this great work that God is doing is how will heaven respond to this covenant, this deal, this contract? And how will you respond? How will all of us respond to those terms of that contract or deal? And then lastly, a thread that runs through all of these passages we're looking at here today is resting in God's presence, which the fundamental question to that is when you find rest, when you finally stop going around and whatever, that's because what? You realize you have what you need. And when we think about the instruction about Shabbat, and we'll be taking a look more about that as we move along here today, that really is a question that is fundamental below Shabbat, below the Sabbath ideas, is that what do we really need? Because we can always say, oh, I need this a little bit more, a little bit more of this, a little bit more of this, and a little bit more of that. But finding true rest, and that is really symbolized in reaching, coming into the promised land, because that's what God calls it. He calls the land His rest, meaning what? You have reached your destination. You know, it's one of those things that with all of our navigation tools today, one of the last things you'll see is there, you have reached your destination. You are at your destination. So that's what? Should we expect more turns and directions after that? No. Why? Because you've reached your destination. You're like, I need to go try to find something else, to find some other direction, take some other turn. No, because you have reached your destination. All right, so let's move on here a little bit further and look at the covenant identity and calling. So in Genesis 35, we see that heaven is reaffirming Yaakov's name, reaffirming Jacob's name as Israel. So again, we've talked about this a few weeks ago, the difference in the name, the change of name. You were called Yaakov. The fundamental meaning of that is that which juts out or your heel. But also it can be meant colloquially as one who juts into things, in other words, a deceiver. So colloquial meaning of Yaakov is to deceive. So that's why you get that meaning that shows up in the connection to Yaakov's name, because that connects back to the birthright and the fact of the birthright in both the first part and then the blessing after that. Both of those, his father Yitzhak tried to direct that to whom? Esau, the firstborn. He kept trying to direct both of those to the firstborn, because culturally, that's where it goes. It goes to the firstborn. The firstborn get all of the blessings and the rights of the family. But heaven's direction was, no, it's not going to go to the firstborn. It's going to go to the secondborn, a later born one. So thus, the route that it took, and you can debate one side or the other, should Yaakov have been one that tried to, quote, help God out, unquote, with the directions from his mother on how to get the birthright and then the blessing. But the ultimate scope of things is that is the direction where the blessing and the birthright were going to go. That was heaven's direction. And you see in the passage here today in Genesis 35 that there's a reaffirmation of this. This is after he's returned back from his going round and round and round with his uncle there of Laban on where he was going to get his blessings from. So that was a part of the whole maturing process. Yaakov had to learn by getting, quote, a taste of his own medicine, unquote, from Laban, who was even more devious and double-dealing than you might argue that Yaakov was in getting the direction of heaven to go in his way. But the difference there with Laban is that he was actually fighting against the direction of where heaven was looking to take the whole situation. Then in Isaiah 43, the short little passage we looked at here today, you see that Elohim says, I have called you by name. You are mine. Now remember who Yeshayahu the prophet is talking to. Isaiah the prophet is talking to people who are in the throes of being cast into exile. One part of the people of Israel, the northern kingdom, already hauled off by the kingdom of Assyria. Now the southern kingdom, came to be known as the handwriting on the wall, was coming for the southern kingdom, that Babylon would come and haul them away as well. So for that message to say to those people who are really wondering, does God even really care about us anymore? He still says to them, I have called you by name. You are mine. You are mine. So the question is, that when we face adversity, just like our forefathers in the faith faced adversity being hauled off into captivity, you know, there were some that got hauled off into captivity. It wasn't their fault. That was what other people, there were people in charge, people in authority, they were the ones that took the whole spiritual direction of the nation down into the dumpster and set the dumpster on fire. So it wasn't their fault that they got hauled off, like we read about Daniel, the whole book of Daniel. That was not his fault whatsoever. When you think about the prophet, you know, Ezekiel, it wasn't his fault either. But yeah, he got hauled off into captivity just like everybody else did. So thus that message coming, I've called you by name, you are mine. So throughout time, you keep seeing that this declaration, the change of name, is something that is saying, hey, look, through whatever twists and turns your life is going to take, the Lord is still going to be with you because you are a different person than you were. You know, the kingdom of the adversary might try to convince you that you're still the whatever schlub that you were when heaven saved us out of our house of bondage, whatever our house of bondage was, whatever we were in bondage to before, that we're still that person. No, we are not anymore. That's one of the great promises we have of the new covenant prophecy in Jeremiah 31, that whatever it was that we were, those iniquities would be removed from us and remembered no more. That's one of the great promises of it, and something we memorialize every time Yom Kippur or the Day of Atonement comes around. We memorialize that the covering of sins, transgressions, and iniquities, the removal of that, and then heaven considers those forgotten. And in Matthew chapter 11, we see in that short little passage that Yeshua is reaffirming the Father, what the Father is saying and revealing and that this personal invitation is coming to us, that we can find our rest in the Messiah, that this entering the promised land is something that all of us do. That's why we go over it kind of in Yom Kippur time period when we go through Hebrews chapters 3 and 4, because they really talk about again and again repeating, I swore my wrath, you would not enter my rest, and talking about that pivotal time period in Israel's history where they came up to the border of the promised land and saw that, well, they heard the, quote, bad report from those spies, the 10 of them that went in, the 10 of them that gave a bad report and basically talked down what God was going to do. The wall's too high, the giant's too big, there's no way we can fight them. No, we can't do that. But thus you had only two that stood up and said, hey, look, God says he's going to do this. And, you know, you think in the back of the minds, hey, that was a part of Moses' message there, which is the whole big chunk of the first chapters of Deuteronomy, was a reminder to that second generation. Look what the creator of heaven and earth has already done, has taken you out, taken the first generation out of the house of bondage. It is now moving you toward that land of rest. Look what the Lord has already done. But then, you know, don't be like the first generation. Don't be like them that came all the way up to the border and went, we can't do this. Well, true, we can't. And some of the great giants and things that we face in our lives, there are giants that are too insurmountable for us. You know, we think we've got everything all sketched out. Everything is just fine. That there are principalities of the air, as the Bible talks about them, that are pulling a lot of strings, both overtly and covertly, in the world and making things happen. Now, do we have mastery over those things? No. No, we don't. And in those things that then start creeping into our own world and keep reminding us, or I should say, deceiving us about how wonderful the chains were of our Egypt that we were in. Yeah, how wonderful they were. And we just start pining for those things. As the Apostle Paul says, we get dragged away and enticed. We get enticed to go back to the house of bondage, just like we read about our forefathers in faith did. They kept thinking, oh, you know, the food was so great. Oh, we had wonderful things when we were there. And we can keep fooling ourselves about how the bondage that we were in before was so wonderful. Yeah, the leeks and everything was so great. Now, when you think about divine presence and restoration, you know, in the passages that we've said, yes, John, you have a comment or a question? Yes. Yes. Yep. Yes. Well, those who are, you know, when they talk about called by my name, well, we'll be getting to that in just a bit, but the idea, a bit of a reminder of what does name mean? You know, we may think, oh, Jeff, just to pull it out of theological things for just a moment. Called by the name of Jeff. What does that mean? Does that mean anything really other than what? What I'm known for, right? What is Jeff known for? Well, you may know me for certain things. In another context, people know me for some other things as well. So thus, Jeff has different meanings for different people based on what? What I've done, what my character is like, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So thus, the concept of shame, or that's the Hebrew word for name, is the same. Shame is the same. It means your character, your reputation, what you are known for. So thus, call by my name means what? Then bringing that back into a passage like Isaiah. Call by my name means, it means that you're, if you have and you are known by the creator of heaven and earth and known as a reputation for that, what should your character be like? Should be reflecting that of the creator of heaven and earth. So that's one of the big swipes that you see in the prophets again and again. when it says, my name is blasphemed among the nations because of you. So who has changed the name of the Lord? The people's behavior has changed the name of the Lord, meaning what that reputation, the character, what it's known for. You know, because if I come across as being the, we always talk about in the realm of customer service. If you have somebody and you go into a business or you go into a restaurant or something like that, you meet somebody who's working there. And if they treat you poorly, what then happens? These days, they get on to all of the networks. They get onto Yelp. You know, they get onto Google and they just start leaving reviews. One star, one star, one star, all the way down and just flaming up the comments. And then if a lot of business people today will then go on and start playing whack-a-mole on all the comment boards to try to respond to all of the negative comments. Why? Because that person's interaction with one person who worked in that particular business or a restaurant or whatever took the reputation, the character of that business down, made it low. So similar thing is going on here when you're talking about the name of the Lord, is that the behavior of those who have you could say that they are called by it, have a clarion call go out before you, what is it that you are describing yourself as, or are other people describing as you? Oh, he is one who is called by the name of the Lord. So then, if you act reprehensibly, if you act in a bad character, you're not reliable, you know, you are double dealing, etc., like that, backstabbing, what then will people think? They'll think, yeah, the Lord is just like that, because look at how there are people who are called by their name and those that are supposedly devout followers, how they behave. So, hey, that's how the Lord is like. And I know I've heard it personally. I've had neighbors that have said, yeah, I haven't had any connection with God for decades because so-and-so in some church back there behaved so badly. And it's like, if believers are like that, I want nothing to do with them whatsoever. So that is what name reputation is thus all about. So thus, when you're seeing in the context of back into Isaiah and talking to these people into exile, why are they going into exile? What Isaiah is speaking to in his right immediate context. Why are they going into exile? Turn their back on God. You know, you have descriptions like in Ezekiel where the priests are literally turning their back on God. They're serving in the temple, literally turning their backs to God as they serve, but then also how they behave, how you treat other people. So yeah, there are people in Israel, they were following God's instructions. They actually had the heart of God, the character of God. But then there were other people that made the whole reputation for what Israel was known for as being what? Odious. Lower than all the nations, etc. So hopefully that helps with the idea of people being called by your name, what you are known for, and then called by the name of the Lord. So, you know, we may have our own reputations, but are our own character, what we're known for, is that parallel to what the Lord is known for? Because for many people, knowing us may be their only pass or one of their few passes that they have of learning who God is, who the creator of heaven and earth is. So thus, that's why the Apostle Paul talks about ambassadors for the Messiah. We are ambassadors of the Messiah. Ambassadors do what? They represent the kingdom that they are sent by. An ambassador is sent by a particular country to do what? To represent, to act in the place of. So, you know, we could certainly say to ourselves, well, I certainly am not acting in the place of God in this particular place, but when you are known, called by the name, meaning that is what people know you as being a follower of God, you are representing the kingdom, because they may not know the difference between, hey, the way so-and-so acts and the reputation of the Lord. They may only know it by the way we behave. So that's one of the great warnings of it is by the kingdom, is that, you know, when we are make it known, we live a lifestyle of being called by the name of the Lord, realize that we are an advertisement of the kingdom. So what God has done with us in transforming us, that it is not our character, our name that's coming out, but the Lord's name that is coming out. That's why you see, like in Matthew chapter 5, where it says, you know, let your light shine before men, that they may see your good works, and then do what? Give you a high five? No. Praise your Father in heaven. Because they will know, okay, what the light that we see, the good works we see from you, is coming from where? That's coming from heaven down and through you and through all of us. So yes, as we move forward and we see that that's when God is appearing to Yaakov, and we saw that in the previous appearances there, first with the ladder and then with the wrestling, and here now with this encounter of calling the place Beit El, that this is pointing to the importance of the divine presence and worship. You know, when we are getting together and praising the name of God, one of the things that we always are keeping in mind is that calling upon the presence of the Lord to be here. And that in, you know, we're not like in the times of where you have the temple. When the temple was inaugurated and in place, thus you had a very particular manifestation of the Lord's presence there. But we can sometimes not think that the presence of the Lord is here with any particular group of leaders, because what? It's not the temple. It's not the tabernacle. We don't see the pillar of cloud and coming up from where the presence of the Lord is. And we may think, oh, you know, we're away from the presence of the Lord. And you see in the prophets that similar sort of idea, even the time when the temple was actually standing, they got that idea too. Like, oh, you know, we're away from the temple, so God doesn't see us. Okay, yeah, we think that the creator of heaven and earth is not going to see whatever it is, what we're doing, only if we're right in the vicinity of where God's house is. That's the only time when he actually has any sort of idea of who we are and what we're doing. Now you're seeing about the one who knows and sees all things. So we see that this momentum, this gaining spiritual momentum, goes from Beit El, the house of God. It starts picking up momentum, because later on in the Torah, you see Beit El, this place where the altar is, then gets formalized and it becomes a very specific altar in the tabernacle, in the Mishkan, because the Mishkan is, that is the dwelling place, because Mishkan comes from Shachan, which means to dwell, and Mishkan means the place of the dwelling, and that is the tabernacle. Well, then we move down further, and it takes on even more weight, where you see, like in John chapter 1, and it says, what? The Word became flesh and tabernacled, or pitched his tent among us. So this keeps gaining power, where you have Beit El to Mishkan or tabernacle to the Word made flesh, the tabernacle becoming flesh. So as we see also in these passages, comfort in suffering, because you see in our passage we're looking at in Genesis 35 that Yaakov was facing loss of Rachel. She died in the midst of childbirth. And then Yitzhak died also from old age, 180, ripe old age, as it says. And you see also the prophet Yeshayahu is speaking to the exiles, people in exile, going into exile, facing trials, facing the sense of being forgotten. But the promise keeps coming through, The Lord has not forgotten you. You are called by the name. Called by the name of the Lord, you are not forgotten. And you see a similar thing show up in the book of Revelation. When he says, you know, I've given you a what? A new name. A white stone with your name upon it. Where only you know what it is. Because each one of us only knows where God has taken us from. All right, so one of the things we'll be zeroing in a lot more here today is in Matthew chapter 11, verses 25 through 30. Come to me, all of you who are weary and heavy burdened. So the idea of redemption and rest. Now, let's look at this a little bit further in the passage and just go over it one more time. We read it earlier. At that time, Yeshua said, I praise you, Father, Lord of heaven and earth, that you have hidden these things from the wise and intelligent and have revealed them to infants. Yes, Father, for this way was well-pleasing in your sight. All things have been handed over to me by my Father, and no one knows the Son except the Father, nor does anyone know the Father except the Son, and anyone to whom the Son wills to reveal him. Come to me, all who are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble of heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light. So what we see here is you see that Yeshua is singing praises here to the Father for revealing this truth to, as he calls it, infants, rather than those who are self-reliant, the wise and the intelligent. Now, it's very interesting. We'll see this a little bit further in one of the prophets talk about this sense of infants, is that, yes, infants in what? Your sense of wanting to learn and being open to learning and the wise and intelligent thinking that you already know everything. As you know, if you work in some sort of an organization or a company or something, which is an easier employee? The one that wants to learn or the one that thinks he knows everything? Yeah, look out for the one who thinks he knows everything. And that's I know if you've been around an organization for a long time, you have to always watch yourself. I know I have to watch myself too, because if I get thrown into a different task or a different role or something, I always have to remind myself, okay, yeah, you've been here for 26 years, but this is a new role for you. So leave the option open that you don't know everything about what's going on here. That, yeah, you know, what a shock. You don't know everything. So leave that idea open. Be teachable. It doesn't mean that you just be infantile, but be teachable in the way you approach learning. So one of the things we also see in this passage about how you see a declaration of this unique authority and relationship that the Messiah has with the Father, and about offering rest, true rest, because this is not just, you know, finding rest in the teachings of some guru or teacher. You know, you follow their set of things and then they'll get you on the 15 keys to success or whatever things that you see all the videos that go around about self-improvement and self-help. You do these six hacks and you'll find a way to fulfillment and success. No, rather, this is like with getting to your destination. You're not looking to go any further. You're not like you just sit back and just take a spiritual snooze for the rest of your life. Rather, it is you're not always yearning, oh, I need to be somewhere else. Oh, I need to be somewhere else. Yeah, you may have had some times in your life like that. I know I've had those times in my life too, where you just get antsy because you feel like you need to be somewhere else doing something else. You can't just relax and just sit back and say, I need to be doing something. You can't just sit down because you just jump up again and realize, no, I need to be doing something. I'm missing something else to be able to be at peace. So that comes as it's talked about in this passage here in Matthew chapter 11 about the yoke of the Messiah. So let's talk a little bit more about some of what's going on underneath the hood of this with the language involved. The word that's translated rest, and the Greek word there in Matthew 11, 28, is anapao. And anapao is defined as to give rest, refresh, or cause to cease from labor. And noted here in the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament, it often translates the Hebrew word of nuach, which means to rest or repose. Now, you know, for example, Noah, his name in Hebrew is Noach, and Noach comes from nuach, which means rest, which is very significant because that is a picture of what the ark in the flood was all about. You were going to enter God's rest. And was that just what? To take a nap on the ark? No, because if you didn't find your nuach on the ark, what was there for you? Death, drowning. That's what was outside of the nuach of God, outside the rest of God, outside the ark of God, was death, destruction. So thus, in that case, it wasn't just, you know, going to find a nice pillow and curling up for a good snooze. No, this was the saving of a person from death and destruction. So in a specific way, you see that this word nuach is used in the fourth commandment there in the Ten Commandments, Exodus chapter 20, verse 11. In particular, if you look out and you see it says, "For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested," or nuach, "on the seventh day." Now, it's interesting to note that if you roll back the clock a little bit to Genesis chapter 2, where you get the first description of the Shabbat instruction, it uses a different word. So in Genesis chapter 2, verses 2 and 3, it says, "By the seventh day, God completed his work which he had done, and he rested." It's the word Shabbat, which is where we get Shabbat from. "He rested on the seventh day and from all his work which he had done, and he blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because in it he rested," again, Shabbat, "from all his work which he had, which God had created and made." So that's significant. So if you take a look a little bit further, this is a commentary from the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament about this. In Genesis 2, verses 2 through 3, Shabbat, or the cessation from labor, describes God's rest. But in Exodus 20, verse 11, nuach is used. Hence, man is not only to cease from his worldly pursuits, but he is to enter into a state of victory or salvation rest. It is only the presence and favor of God that makes this rest, as well as martial rest, possible. And it continues on and says, "True rest or salvation is to be declared in the Messianic age, but there will be an initial and climactic judgment on Israel in the form of preaching this rest in foreign languages. However, God ultimately will accomplish true rest for his elect people through his Messiah." Now, let's kind of take a look at some of these particular passages that are mentioned here in this passage in the Theological Word Book of the Old Testament, and particular Exodus chapter 31. You might recognize this. It's a part of that song that we have for the Shema in each one of our services. So Exodus chapter 31, from verse 12 through verse 17. "The Lord spoke to Moshe, saying, 'But as for you, speak to the sons of Israel, saying, you shall surely observe my Sabbaths, for this is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you.'" And sanctifies, that's kadosh, which is where we get the word kadosh or holy from. "Therefore, you are to observe the Sabbath, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death. For whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. For 6 days work may be done, but on the seventh day there is a Sabbath of complete rest," in which in Hebrew is where you get the Hebrew equivalent of underline and boldface, which is Shabbat Shabbaton. So in Hebrew, they emphasize things by repeating the same word in a couplet like that. So Sabbath, a complete rest, Shabbat, Shabbaton. Holy to the Lord, whoever does any work on the Sabbath day shall surely be put to death. So the sons of Israel shall observe the Sabbath to celebrate the Sabbath throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It is a sign between me and the sons of Israel forever. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, but on the seventh day he ceased, or Shabbat, from labor and was refreshed. So that's a very important point when we look through this concept of Shabbat. And when we say rest, it is a sign, in looking in this passage earlier, that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. So what is the Shabbat a memorial of? Not only of creation, because in 6 days he created and then he stopped, he's Shabbat, but it is also that he is the one who kadashes. He's the one who makes you kadosh, or holy. So we may think, oh, we are holy because we Shabbat, we cease, we stop. No, that is a sign that the Lord is the one who makes us holy, makes us set apart from it. So it's not like the Sabbath is something that spiffs you up and makes you great. No, rather it's the other way around. It is that God, the creator of heaven and earth, is the one who calls us out. He makes us separate from the world, even though we still live in the world. He makes us separate. He makes us holy. He makes us kadosh. So that then is a sign of that. Hey, he is the one who brought us and recreated us, made us separate from the world, returning us to where the creator is wanting to take the whole world. So as we continue on back to our Matthew chapter 11 passage, and the Greek word there for zygos, which is translated yoke there in Matthew 11 verse 29, and it talked about the wooden bar. Yeah, it's basically in various eras, it's the same idea. It is a structure that hooks together, you know, one or more animals so that you can usually pull something. And thus, you know, the more animals you have, the more ox power or horse power that you have to accomplish your task, to either go somewhere or to pull something, to move something. So one of the things that you see in the Torah when it talks about uses various object lesson commands about what wearing two types of cloth together, to have two types of seed in one field, and then to also don't yoke two different animals together. They're all saying the same idea, is that if you have different types of things together and you're trying to accomplish one task, if those different things together are mismatched, you may not get to where you're going to go. If you put two different seed in your field and you're expecting one particular crop, you're going to have some particular problems, especially if you just mix them all together and then sow your field with them. Good luck trying to harvest that with any sort of speed or efficiency. You know, if it's much easier to do an entire wheat field or a whole field of corn or something like that than it is to do what? If it's mix of wheat and corn, okay, good luck with that harvest, because your workers are what? Going to be tromping around trying to do one crop and then the other crop. So very difficult to be efficient on that. And, you know, if you have two different animals working together, it's the same thing like with aviation. We were talking about planes earlier. You know, you might have noticed, if you've ever looked into a cockpit of the plane you're flying on, that there between the pilots, between the pilot and the co-pilot, they have their set of controls that they have there. And it looks like a whole bunch of levers that they have there. Those are typically where you have the ways that you increase the power to the engines. But the reason why those are separate levers there are those are for all of the engines together. So the pilot may and often does move all of the power for all of the engines together the same way, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes there's like wind shear differences or whatever. There may be a reason why you need to have more power on one of the engines versus the other. But while, look, if you weren't trying to actually do that, if suddenly some yokel at the aircraft maintenance place tried to help you out, if he tried to help you out and tried to do something, he put two different engines in your plane that had different power on them. And then you try to take off and like, whoa, you know, this like pulling one side or the other side. And you, if you're not expecting it and the pilot is inexperienced, you can have a disaster going on. Well, just imagine what it's like then with two animals that are mismatched working together. It can be huge problems. And thus, that's why you see the Apostle Paul talking about being unequally yoked when you have like a marriage and also with a business relationship. That if you are two going in different directions, have completely different destinations where you're going at, it can be in a gigantic challenge to be getting to your destination in. Now, it can be done, just like flying a plane with completely mismatched engines. It can be done, but wow, is it difficult like that? And the chance of having some challenges is, in particular, pretty high. So thus, when you see, talked about just looking culturally on this, you'll see a note here from the Jewish Annotated New Testament talking about yoke. It's connected to the study of Torah, and the rabbis note that one who accepts, quote, the yoke of the Torah, unquote, is excused from governmental duties and worldly cares. And you see the similar thing that's in the nation of Israel. In modern Israel, that's been a challenge, because one of the things just in, you know, culturally, because it comes out and there's lots of citations from the Mishnah and the Talmud about that, is that the study of Torah is one of your utmost tasks in life. Well, the thing though is that, and you can see it, like if you've seen Fiddler on the Roof, you see a similar dynamic there. And even one of the songs is about that, where Tevye is what? He wants to just go and study Torah all day long. Well, what about for actually getting things done in your household or in society, etc.? Thus, you know, you can't have everybody, you could say it another way, everybody can't go to seminary and become a pastor or this or that or the other, because then what? Where then are your other parishioners going to go, etc.? So thus you see that yoke is about teaching. It's about the teaching or leadership. Where is your teaching or your leadership coming from? So thus, when the Messiah is saying, take my yoke, take the Messiah's yoke on you, because my yoke is easy and my burden is light. And in the context of that, when you see in how it came to be known later on in tradition about that your yoke is the Torah, it's not just the Torah. It is all of the halachot, or the ways of walking, the traditions that go along with that in any particular tradition or under any particular teacher. They may have lots of other things that go added on to that. Those can be good, or they can be detrimental. They can actually take you into a different direction, kind of like those mismatched engines on a plane, mismatched animals in a yoke that's carrying either a wagon or carriage or whatever like that. You know, you think what happens in your car if you've got some problems with a wheel and heaven forbid one of your brakes locks up on you. You might have had that privilege. You see it happen with commercial trucks quite often. their air brakes will lock up on them, and you'll see sections of pavement where they've dragged their tires for a section because their brakes locked up on them. So when you're mismatched in your wheels moving together, you can have some serious problems. So one of the things that we see, and also looking under the hood there, that the word matetes, or learn from disciple, is also from what you get in Hebrew back in the Greek version of the Old Testament, where it talks about the Greek word of lamad, which means to learn or to be taught. Larry, you have a comment or a question?
I've often thought that when he said, my yoke is light, and people are thinking, well, I don't want a yoke on me. What idea? And then really, when you're thinking about it, you're talking about being equal. But we're not equal with Yeshua. But he is so strong, he's going to do almost all the work. In fact, he's already done almost all the work.
Yep.
And so therefore, it's going to be really easy for you if you're in his yoke.
One thing I'm somewhat familiar with is that with sled dogs and sled dogs, is it good to have your whole team to be all your lead dogs? No. Why not? They all go in the wrong direction, because when you give the order for one direction or the other to G or Taha, what is going to be giving the instructions to the rest of the team? The lead dog. The lead dog knows what to do when they hear the instructions and goes that way. The rest of the team will follow. So, you know, it's like if you're in your own organization, if everybody is a leader, you give an instruction, then what happens? You get all kinds of chaos. Everybody is going in all kinds of different directions. We got Anne and then Rose here.
Yes, I think about how the Lord said, whose inscription is on the coin? Caesar's. Yeah. So, well, render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's.
Yep. So what belongs to God? Everything. Yes. Yeah, Caesar, the realm there is for coinage and the things related to commerce and trade. But who is the one who really keeps commerce and trade all together? And we've talked about this before with the whole idea of Adam Smith and the idea of the sensibilities and moral principles, that you may think, oh, this, quote, invisible hand is what rules the commerce in the marketplaces and such like that. Well, okay, great. You might have that, but what happens if everyone is a thief? How well is your commerce going to work? You see in some countries where you have rampant problems of that, and commerce doesn't work, because oftentimes your shipments don't get to their destinations because they get directed somewhere else by a third party who wants to take ownership of it, to put that lightly. So where you have the breakdown of the morality, where everyone is looking for the good of somebody else, that's the kingdom of God, looking for the good of everyone else. You know, the kingdom of man is what? The opposite of the golden rule. You know, it's, yes, whoever has the gold makes the rules. Yeah, that becomes the way society is without the view from above. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And strength, me'od, means your resources. Everything, what makes you strong, your resources, you know, your wealth of all different types. So love the Lord your God with all your wealth as well. And thus, love your neighbor as yourself becomes an easier proposition for that when it's based on that. I think, Rose, you have a comment or? Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, your mother raised seven children.
And she used to say, we'd all want to be in charge, right?
Yeah, we all want to be in charge.
And she used to say that there was too many chiefs and not enough Indians.
Yes.
So, yeah, you have to have leadership, and then you have to have people willing to trust and obey, to follow.
Yeah, indeed.
Finishing up on that thought, so in Israel, you have I don't know what they call them, the Hasidic Jews are not called Hasidic Jews, but they're yeshiva students, and they didn't have to go to war for years and years and years. They'd only study the word of God, and hopefully they were leaders. I don't know, were they hiding somewhere in the midst of that? Were a bunch of, you know, godly leaders, you would hoped that they would learn that, but then so they didn't want to, or they didn't want to, or they felt themselves above having to go to war for a country. But so Caesar controls the army and controls that part of it. So, you know, Jesus said, well, whose inscription is Caesar? Well, Caesar and his army, but the Lord has his army, and his he's the Lord of hosts, so he's above all the armies. So kind of taking it a little further than with the coin. Mm. I don't know, there's some other point I wanted to make about that, but, you know, that the leader thinks he has an army, you know, an army of strength, but the strength is from God alone.
Kind of bringing all these passages here together, one of the things we see in our Matthew 11 passage is that it's really revealing God's choice to hide truth from the wise and to reveal it to infants. You know, it echoes his choice of Yaakov over Esau. Now, we saw in the whole context of it that Yaakov came around. He had this real turning around where he reconciled with his brother. But then also, his brother was willing to reconcile with him, even though Yaakov had quote, taken everything from him, took the birthright, took the blessing from him. Still, he was willing to work toward approaching his brother again. And you notice we had left it off with our previous passage last week where the two sides were, had the reunion, and then, you know, Yaakov said, I'm not going to go with you. Well, he said he was going to go with them, but then left and went to a different route. But you see that in this particular passage, they were sort of dwelling together, but because they had started to become too numerous on both sides, both Yaakov and Esau, that they couldn't live together anymore. They're depleting the resources of the area, because, you know, if you're talking about an agrarian society, if you overgraze, that's a bad thing because you're not going to get what grasses and such. You're going to really limit your ability to have something. Yeah, you kill it, especially if you get things that are ripping up the roots and everything else. So, especially sheep, yes. So you have to keep them moving a lot. But you see also that there was a separation, and you see it kind of happening between these two parties of Esau down to Edom. So that's modern day southern Jordan right now, down to, and that's like the east bank of the Jordan River, down towards the Gulf of Aqaba, of the, it's not really the Red Sea, but the Gulf of Aqaba that comes up. And you see that Yaakov separated his family toward the other side, toward the western side of the Jordan River. And that indeed is a part of a sign that happens through history, that there would be a difference and a separation between the two sort of groups of people, between those that really want to be close to God, to have that kind of Beit El, the house of God experience, and those that treat this kind of birthright, this kind of legacy, as something, you trade it because you're hungry or because you have some other sort of inclination you want to follow after. Larry, you have your hand up there.
Yeah, I'm thinking also, Esau had a whole army with him.
Yes, he had a whole lot of people with him.
And I'm thinking that maybe he said, yeah, okay, you go ahead and I'll follow you, but I'm not sure if I trust him.
Yeah, that's a whole lot of people with him, exactly. So that's one of the things that you see, that God is the one who is sovereign over all in making these kinds of selections. Selections of saying, hey, this group of people are ones that really have a heart to follow after the creator of heaven and earth. Now, as we move on here further, we see about the yoke that Yeshua provides. That yoke is one of what? You must submit to the yoke, to have the yoke put upon you. You know, it says, take the this burden upon you, because it is light, this yoke upon you. So thus, that sort of submission to saying, hey, I will be led by somebody else. And, you know, to the point earlier, we may think that we don't have any yoke upon us, that we are completely freed and we are our own person. Well, the thing is all of us are in a yoke to something or other. The ones who don't think that they're led by anything are really fooling themselves. Because if you are not led by something, you will be what? Wandering around, aimless. In which case, you know, you are your own leader in that. You are yoked with what? The Bible calls it folly, calls it, you know, lack of wisdom. You are what? You're running into everything. You have no direction whatsoever. Or you can yoke with any sort of passing so-called, you know, powers of heaven and earth. There are lots of so-called powers of heaven and earth that will take us into all kinds of directions that we don't want to go. But do we actually see who it is that we're being yoked up with, to see what kind of power it is that we're being yoked up with? And one of the things that we see, that this redemption as a part of entering God's rest, that these blessings that finally come down, that just like with Ishmael, we can really marvel at the fact that the creator of heaven and earth blessed Ishmael. And we can think, and we have times like this where you have certain quarters of the descendants of Ishmael that continue to follow with what was prophesied on them, that the descendants would have their hands on everybody's neck and everybody would have their hands on his neck. And that continues on. That legacy continues on for some of the descendants. But you see also that the blessing goes to the descendants of Esau as well, and Edom. And throughout Israel's history, Edom is seen as a continual source of just prodding and problems and attacks and a continual source of, you know, dragging down the people of God. And thus it's like, yes, you are relatives of Edom. We can say, okay, spiritually speaking, that we are descendants of Edom, but we don't want to go in that direction of Edom anymore. Rather, what do we want? We want those from Edom and Moab. Moab ends up being slightly to the north of Edom, and ends up being in some cases grouped into the same as Edom. But we read here in recent times about Ruth. Ruth came what? Out of Moab. Rather than just bringing those sorts of ideas, foreign practices into the people of God, rather know what is the call. The call is, come out. Come out of those particular nations. And that's what we've seen throughout the people of God, is that we may think that one particular country or empire or such, that it's just completely evil. Everybody there is completely evil. No, that has never been the case of where you see the legacy of the family of God. Now, there may be a remnant. Now, also sad to say that within the people of God, there is also a remnant. So just because you were called by the name of the Lord does not mean that you are actually following along with the name of the Lord. Because throughout the history that we see throughout the scripture, we see that also there is a remnant of people who are called by the name of the Lord, who actually do follow along with his ways. So that invitation, that all who are weary, that we see in Matthew chapter 11, verse 28, that this is something that's a promise that goes out to all nations, not only those that are within the commonwealth of Israel, everyone who is grafted into the great olive tree that the Lord has planted, and is continuing to graft on people from the nations into. Come out of her, my people. Come out of her. Come out of, in that case, it's called Babylon or confusion. Come out of those lands of confusion. Come out of her. And Lord willing, we'll see more and more and more of the people coming out of Babylon, coming out of Edom, coming out of these places that are either ignorant of the ways of God or hostile to the ways of God. But the Lord always has people within those areas that he is calling. So thus, you know, we as the people of God need to also call for the wisdom of God to see other people the way he sees them. You know, that's, and we see quite clearly that there is not just a blanket, you could say, smoothing over or whitewashing any sort of diabolical behavior that is happening with any of these powers. Certainly, you see that that correction from heaven is coming, but not everyone who is in those areas is one people who buy into that kind of thing. So yes, as we pray for the peace of Yerushalayim, that peace of Yerushalayim, as we recall, is one that is calling out to all nations to come in. And as we see in the Messianic era, that is one where all the nations will be coming in. They will be leaving all of those former powers and strongholds that had grip over them. And when Sar Shalom, the Prince of Peace, the Messiah, is here and returns, all of those principalities and powers that had grip over so many people, they would be broken. And that's one of the great news messages that we have, that, you know, we are called, and that when we are called, we listen. And then when we listen, we get transformed in the process, so that, yeah, we may be from so-and-so place before, but that's not who we are now. We are called by a new name. Hallelujah.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions, or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info, hallel.info.